It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Almost immediately upon being sworn in, Governor Wolf called on state legislators back in January to enact an adequate and equitable education funding formula, one that provides equal opportunity to Pennsylvania students. As the legislature prepares for serious budget talks, it's no secret that there's a disparity in education funding in the Commonwealth. According to the National Forum on Education Statistics, this state has the largest funding gap between wealthy and poor school districts. So what can be done to close that gap? I'm joined now in studio by representatives of the Campaign for Fair Education Funding. Patrick Dowd, the former Pittsburgh City Councilman, who is the Executive Director of Allies for Children, and Cheryl Kleiman, attorney with the Education Law Center. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for having us.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Let's start off by having you explain what the Campaign for Education Funding is all about. What is the goal of this campaign? Patrick, why don't
you begin? Paul. So the Campaign for Fair Education Funding is really a group of now over 50 organizations. We come from all walks. We have educators and business leaders, advocates, nonprofit leaders, faith-based groups, civic groups, education associations, you name it, we're in this coalition. And we've all come together. We have lots of different views on lots of different issues, but on this one, we have a common agenda. We want to make sure that the Pennsylvania legislature adopts by 2016 a fair funding formula for the students in public schools here in Pennsylvania. So it's a big effort and one that we're excited about. We feel that there's a lot of momentum behind this, and we've got a lot of work to do yet.
Do other states have predictable funding formulas, and why doesn't Pennsylvania have one? Cheryl?
Most other states have recognized that not having a fair funding formula leads to the disparities you talked about, and that using a funding formula to distribute their education dollars makes sense and are using one. Pennsylvania is currently one of only three states that does not use a fair funding formula.
And this is something that the governor pointed out back in January.
That's right.
But again, why haven't we had one? What has prevented us from doing what most, if not all, of the states in the U.S. are doing as far as education funding?
47 states have put in place a formula. Pennsylvania did at one time a few years ago, actually, back at the 2008 time period, had a formula. But really, since 1992, we've been operating without one. And it's really a complex political problem. And one that this campaign has endeavored to try to change. And also the legislature has itself acknowledged that there's a problem. The legislature created what's called the Basic Education Funding Commission. This is a commission to look at one single line item, the basic education funding line item, that distributes $5.5 billion annually, and to propose a formula. And they're coming out with a report in about 10 days.
How do you think schools should be funded across the state of Pennsylvania? We welcome your ideas, your critiques, your comments at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. If you want to join our conversation today with Patrick Dowd and Cheryl Kleiman, the problems that have existed in this state with regard to educational disparity, we hear so much talk about how it revolves around funding, but is that strictly the issue here, or is there more to it than just a funding issue? Is there more to this than just money and dollars?
Certainly money is not going to solve all the problems. So we're not here to say that, but if we looked at data, and we can talk about a study that was done by two researchers, Baker and Levine, that was released about a year ago, October of 2014, less than a year ago, on funding disparities here in Pennsylvania and the correlation between funding disparities and academic performance. Or we could just use what we know. You know, if we fund students who are already starting off in life with a lot of challenges, if we fund them less, it's just not right. Mm-hmm. We know that we need to provide equitable and adequate funding across all of the districts in Pennsylvania. And we know that in our formula, the campaign's put together a formula, our formula tries to take into consideration those different conditions that cause children to have difficulties and that might require additional funding.
And I would echo Patrick in pointing to some of the research which shows that state finance reforms can have a substantial positive effect on student outcomes, including increases in overall achievement levels and reduction in those achievement gaps we see. So it's one of the reasons we continue to fight for a fair funding solution that serves all students, but especially the groups that have been historically least served by education.
What are some examples that you could give us? I mean, what is an area, let's pick out a couple places in the state of Pennsylvania where the funding is inadequate, where there's a district that's not receiving as much money, and therefore we can see that another better funded part of Pennsylvania is achieving better outcomes, whether that's reflected in test scores or whatever it may be.
Well, let's talk, I mean, to that point, let's talk a little bit about the disparities. If you look across the country, I think this comes from the report that you referred to at the introduction. If you look across the country, the disparities among states in their spending between the highest poverty and the lowest poverty districts, or the highest poverty of the wealthiest districts, is about 15%. That is to say, you know, they might be spending, say, a little bit more than $9,000 per student to a little bit more than $10,000 per student. In Pennsylvania, our gap between our wealthy and poor districts is about 33 to 35%, depending on the study that you look at. And so we're saying that, you know, some students are going to go to school where the school district spending $8,000, and some students are going to go to school where the district spending $24,000. And we know that that gap, particularly in those low-income districts, is going to mean the absence of things like a counselor, a nurse, folks that can help with tutoring, all sorts of programs that kids who are coming from a struggling background are going to need in order to meet the standards that the state has set for the students of Pennsylvania.
When we're talking about what not having the resources looks like at the school and student level, our students are lacking basic educational elements: textbooks, science labs, art classes, tutoring, as Patrick mentioned.
Textbooks?
Textbooks. We're talking about not having textbooks to take home, not having appropriate reading level materials in the classroom. These are not extras. These are basic elements of a quality education that should be available to all of our public school students.
So where is this happening? Where are we hearing that there are no textbooks? That seems inconceivable at, you know, any grade school level, that you wouldn't have the basic materials.
The Education Law Center works with hundreds of families that are impacted by not having the resources the students need to succeed. So we're seeing in schools in Allegheny County, in an elementary school classroom, that there are not resources that are appropriate to the students' reading level. Students are being asked to share textbooks and not being able to take those materials home.
So I was going to ask you, what impact do you see education funding having on students? So if there is a better formula, then what happens? They at least get those textbooks in their hands, the students?
So the idea behind a formula is that there are several ideas, but the first is that districts would have those dollars that they need in order to provide the services, the resources necessary for, as we said, students to meet those standards. But it also, you know, think about a formula, it starts to add some predictability, which is something that we haven't had a tremendous amount of here in Pennsylvania when we think about school funding. Because of the level of state funding that is currently being provided, there's a heavy reliance in this state on property taxes from the local community to provide those funds. And that's not always taxes may be predictable, but the tax base may not be capable of producing the resources required. So we can think about being able to provide the resources to the students that need it, but also being able to provide predictability over the course of time.
And where does the funding come from? If there is a formula let's say the legislature this time around is able to come up with a means for funding education that meets the requirements that you're advocating for, where will the money come from? Where would you suggest? And you're someone who has served in city government. Yeah. So, you know, speaking as a former office holder in Pittsburgh to your fellow state legislators who are office holders in the Capitol. What would you recommend that they do in terms of finding the money, which is, you know, everybody agrees that education should be funding, but nobody seems to be able to agree on how you do it.
Well, first, I'm not entirely sure that everybody agrees yet that I think there's a general sentiment that we need a fair funding formula. What that formula looks like and how much money goes into public education is as yet another part of the debate.
I'm guessing the legislators, though, particularly those, you know, when they're talking, if they happen to be representing one of these districts where they don't have textbooks, I'm sure that they're hearing from their constituents, or at least I would think they would be.
So let's try to separate this just for the purposes of discussion a little bit and mm-hmm. talk about there's a formula, and how the state would provide those dollars is one thing, and then how much money, it's not unrelated, but how much money is another thing. And the campaign has taken a stand on both pieces. So if you'd like, I can explain that
sure.
just a little bit.
No, go ahead.
So the first thing is that the campaign has said in the creation of a formula that we've taken a stand on how much money the state should spend. We've said that the state should do the following. They should determine a base cost. So what does it cost to educate the typical Pennsylvania child to the standards? And then we should count the number of kids in a district. That's a good idea. We don't do that at this point. We should weight the number of kids based on certain factors that could potentially make it difficult, as we said earlier, for students to achieve the standards coming from a deep poverty background or a moderate poverty background. Those might be weighted separately. Being an English language learner, another challenge. Being a student who's experiencing homelessness, yet another challenge. So the point is we would weight the count of students and drive more dollars to those districts that have those students in those kinds of situations. And then we would adjust. We propose adjusting that formula for factors related to the district. Sparsity. Some districts in Pennsylvania have a very large geographic footprint and a very small number of students, and we understand that that creates its own kind of challenges, and so we'd want to account for that and weight or adjust funding for that. Large number of charter schools. This could be another factor. So we've created a formula that takes into consideration these points, and then actually we have a mechanism for determining how those dollars would be derived. Would they come from the local school district or from the state? So we sort of divide out the responsibility, state versus local. If you do that math, we come up with a number that the state legislature should be adding for public education, basic education funding. That's about $3.6 additional billion dollars for public education. So there is a formula question. If you write the formula in a certain way, you'll end up with a certain amount of money potentially, and that's when you get into the second part of the question, which is what you asked.
Right, because no matter what you're saying here is it's going to cost more money, right?
We believe that it will automatically.
And again, it comes back to the question of where does that money come from? Where should it come from?
So we're agnostic on the revenue sources, but you can look at what's happening in the legislature recently and see that the legislature is actually starting to make movement on some of these ideas. There was a bill that passed in the House recently under the leadership of Representative Reid and Speaker Terzai around changing the property tax and looking more closely at the income and sales tax. So you're starting to see some movement potentially in that direction. The governor's talking about a shale tax. So there are, at this point, different items that are being proposed and discussed in the legislature. Mm-hmm. We're not taking a stand on
sure,
which one.
Sure, but I guess if you're advocating that that more money should be spent or that it simply has to be this figure, then I'm just drawing on your political background to say, what would you do just in terms of being creative here? How would you come up with ways to do, and you just outlined them there. Before we take a call, one other question, as long as we're doing some math here, is there a figure we could come up with for what you would estimate to be the average cost of educating a student in Pennsylvania? What would it be per student?
So we did actually calculate that, and we used the number $7,266. The way we calculated this.
And that's per year?
Per year, per student.
And so times how many, roughly?
1.8. I think it's 1.8 school million school-age children.
Which is, and that's therefore how we arrive at the figure of?
No. It's actually, you have to, it's a more complicated math equation. Okay. That's what I said before. You have to count the number of kids. We have a way to count them. We have to count the number of students who are living in deep poverty and wait for that, or count the number of students who are living in moderate poverty and wait for that. So we've come up with a very complicated, we think complicated formula.
And the and kind of the, again, the end goal of yep. these numbers and this complex formula is really to make sure that our state education dollars are being driven to the neediest students. And the schools then ultimately will reduce these inequities that we were talking about.
And you've brought these figures to the attention of legislators.
Specifically to the commission. We've shared our proposal, and while we don't know yet what they're going to report, we're optimistic that there might be some points of overlap.
We are talking with former Pittsburgh City Councilor Patrick Dowd, who is one of the representatives of the Campaign for Fair Education Funding. He is currently the executive director of Allies for Children. Also with us, Cheryl Kleiman, who is an attorney with the Education Law Center, also involved with this effort, this Campaign for Fair Education Funding. You can weigh in on the conversation, 412-246-2002, email essphgh@wesa.fm, on Twitter at essphgh. Let's go to Tony, who is calling from Erie. Tony, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. Hi, Tony.
Hello, how are you doing?
Well, thank you. Go ahead with your comment or question. You're on the air.
Yes. Actually, my wife worked in the Erie School District in Erie, Pennsylvania. And one thing that we found out, it doesn't seem it's not just the state funding, but it's also the local fundings that are having a problem, where they'll go and fund a more well-off school more and give them more give the teachers more tools to teach the students than they do the lower funding. And when they go and redistrict, they make sure that the more wealthy are all in their own little school while everybody else is pushed to other schools, thus giving larger classrooms and having the problems of not giving books out to every student, not being able to take the books home. That's one of my wife's biggest problems, is that she can't give homework out to students because you don't have the books to go home with. And if she was a science teacher, she didn't have the lab to be able to show these kids what science can do.
That's happening
so
in Erie.
Is there any works that are on the way to, have the state help the local local school districts, in this way?
Well, clearly a lack of state funding has contributed mightily to this problem.
Exactly. I mean, I think what was just described is an example about how Pennsylvania's school funding system is somewhat of a perfect storm. We have very little money coming from the state to pay for education, and this places a heavy burden on the local taxpayers and the local community, which for some communities don't have the base to raise those tax dollars. And then we have no fair way to distribute the funding that we do have. So while this is problematic for all students in schools, it has led to certain schools, like in Erie, struggling more than others. So too many of our schools, where there is less money than the affluent communities to fill that gap with local revenue, aren't able to provide basic education services.
How do you respond to criticism that you hear from some, including many lawmakers, that education proponents all want the same thing? They all want more money, and that no matter how much there is in the pot, they're always going to want more.
So I'd start off by saying, first of all, we have to provide an adequate amount of funding, and that currently isn't the case in Pennsylvania. I think there's a general consensus that we have to do a better job as far as providing that funding. That's why you're hearing a general uproar and a general desire for more funding at this time. So I think that's the first thing to point out. And the second thing is, by moving to a student-based funding formula, which is what we're proposing, it's really a way of starting to understand more accurately the costs of providing education. Our goal is actually not only to make sure that we have a funding formula, but really to start to think about how do we understand the cost of this system and how do we hold districts accountable, like the caller mentioned. How do we make sure that those districts are sending those dollars to where the student is going to school, to make sure that that student who is, for example, in poverty and the district's receiving a slightly increased amount of dollars, make sure that they're getting the very services that they need so that the performance of the district, but more importantly, the quality of life over the long haul for that student improves.
We have a caller on the line who would like to discuss something along those lines. Let's go to Tim in Oakland. Hi, Tim.
Hello, Paul.
Tim, you're on with Patrick Dowd.
I'm Jim.
Jim. It's Jim. Okay.
Jim.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
Sorry.
I'm from Oakland. I love the show, Paul. I really love the show. I listen every day. Now, I'm blind, and I can tell you I do a lot of reading, and I know another problem is a lot of kids come to school hungry because the parents can't feed them, the poverty in the home, or divorced parents. They come to school with no home guidance at all. And another problem, the school is going to provide, like, stuff with donuts and things for the kids to eat. That's another big problem. Kids come to school hungry, and they can't concentrate in the classroom.
Well, certainly Patrick Dowd is nodding in agreement with you, Jim.
Oh, yeah. I'll hang up now, Paul, and listen to your comment.
Okay. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, Jim, for the comment. And while it's not exactly directly related to the work that we're doing, it is something that's really important to us at Allies for Children. It's one of the things that we're working on, trying to figure out how we can improve not only the quality of food that students are receiving, particularly in the morning, but the way in which they're able to get it during the day, so as to help on those kinds of situations that you're talking about.
And certainly, Jim, you know, when I was a kid, I would have been happy to have donuts, but I think there's also
a different day.
Yeah, I think there's a push for, I think oatmeal might be, and fruit might be more the standard that folks are advocating for now. Patrick Dowd is a former Pittsburgh City Councilman.
And former school board member.
And school board member. I should mention that as well. Well, there's so many things here. You're also executive director of Allies for Children. Cheryl Klein, an attorney with the Education Law Center, joining us. They are representatives of the Campaign for Fair Education Funding. And this is part of our WESA Life of Learning initiative to have this conversation. And Patrick, before we wrapped up, you wanted to mention something.
No, I was good.
Okay, very good.
Well, if I have a
Cheryl
moment,
wants
I
to
would
something.
Love
exactly.
To say, look, we recognize that this isn't an easy lift for the legislature, but the fact of the matter is it's required by the Constitution. And one of the reasons that many of the states that we've talked about that do have fair funding formulas have been successful in making significant education funding reform have done so because they've been ordered to by the courts. And so this is why the Education Law Center continues this effort to fight for fair education funding in the courts as well.
Okay. Now, Patrick, you remembered what you wanted to mention.
Right. You reminded me.
Yeah.
We do want to let people know that as a campaign, we're really focused on making sure that we're raising awareness around the importance of fair education funding. And so if people are interested, they can reach out to our website, which is fairfundingpa.org, and they can learn more about the campaign and get, you know, sign up for reports from us and all of that. But it's also important to let people know from Western Pennsylvania that we're going to be taking a bus to Harrisburg, a whole bunch of us going up to Harrisburg on June 23rd. So that we can really just sort of take a stand with folks all across the state. There should be hundreds and hundreds of people there that day taking a stand for fair education funding. It's June 23rd, and if people would like to get more information, they can go to the website, fairfundingpa.org, or they can contact me on my cell. It's 412-680-8007. We'd love to have people as far away as Erie, all the way down to Washington, everywhere in between from Western Pennsylvania, heading off to Harrisburg and standing with folks from all across the state for fair funding for our children in public education here in Pennsylvania.
Patrick Dowd, Cheryl Klein, thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, Sasha King joins us to outline the ins and outs of managerial positions, how to seamlessly transition from staff to management while keeping coworkers in mind and new responsibilities in check. That's next when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Congratulations. After years of hard work, you've been promoted to management. While you're confident about your skills as an employee, transitioning to management makes you uneasy. What do you do? Here with the tips you need to go from strong employee to adept manager is independent career consultant Sasha King. Sasha King, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Oh, thank you, Paul.
So an employee is offered the opportunity to move up to management. What steps should be taken when this offer is presented?
First is first, you definitely want to assess your skills. The two methods I like to work with my new managers include taking a StrengthsFinders 2.0 assessment so you have a better understanding of what your strengths are. Also, look over the job description and decide of the big three skills that you would need, where you might need help. The big three would include leadership, people skills, and communication. While you can definitely have flaws in these areas when you're an employee, when you're a manager, these things can be detrimental to the performance of your team. So some questions I usually tell people to consider include, what do you want to accomplish in this role? And what unique skills do you bring to that role? What characteristics do you have that could make you a good leader, or you might have to change or alter in order to be a more effective leader? What will be the key challenges in the role that you were given, especially after assessing the issues and problems that your company is having? And then finally, how will you address these challenges? Once you've done that, I always encourage people to kind of come up with a statement to introduce yourself as a manager to your staff members, because politically you want to make sure you're sending a statement that you're now a manager and that you have goals in mind.
Now, becoming a manager alters your relationships with other office personnel. This is inevitable. It's unavoidable. What advice do you have to help new managers handle office politics involving former peers and fellow managers?
Well, we usually tell people that's a stakeholder problem. And for those of you who may not be familiar with the language of what is a stakeholder, these include supervisors, shareholders if you have a publicly traded company, your partners, your coworkers, suppliers, customers, the team that you will be directing, and lenders sometimes. Now, one thing you always want to take into account, and it frightens me that people don't, when you take on a management position, always consider from the staff and the people that I just mentioned, who are your allies in this new position and who might be your detractors. So you might want to consider who in this staff will help you succeed, and possibly consider, is there anyone who might want to see you fail? Sometimes if you're up against another coworker for that promotion, they might be so blinded with jealousy that they're less likely to help you. I'll never forget a client that I had, his best friend, he were up for the same position. However, he earned the position. At first, his friend threw a few temper tantrums stating that he thought he should have had the position and did less work. He had to actually write a directive for him that if he didn't improve his work, that he was going to have to get rid of him, because you cannot afford to have people with bad politics or to see you fail really take over your projects, because you simply have a factor of someone who doesn't like you as a manager because you're ultimately responsible could get you fired. Another thing you want to think about is your circle of influence. Can you set up meetings or lunches with people who are bosses, team members, and peers to establish rapport? Talk to them about the goals that you have for your group. And also, you might want to research things that you have in common with them. That may make establishing a firm relationship with them and bringing them over to your side and your goals a little easier.
Transitioning to management can involve learning new office procedures, processes, and training. How can managers create learning plans for themselves and the people under them?
One thing you should always consider when you're taking on a management position is you should always consider, if this new position requires you to learn any new systems, structures, or methods that the company uses that at this point in time you have not had to learn. If this is a case, you want to list these skills and actually work on finding training programs, see if they're offered by your company, or see if they if they're not offered by your company, whether your company is willing to pay for the time and cost it would take to do that. A popular thing for some companies like GE, they train a lot of people in the Six Sigma system because that's something that the company uses to operate. So if you're going to take on certain positions within that company, everyone gets training on that. Well, an important thing for you to do as a manager is you have to now be the example for everyone underneath you. So a smart manager schedules training sessions or structures or methods after you've mastered it, or might consider subscribing to a corporate training resource for all of his staff members. Something like Dale Carnegie, Mind Tools is also popular too. So those are all two really great resources that you could use. You could set up a corporate account and everyone can work on their own continuing education.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with independent career consultant Sasha King about transitioning from being an employee to a member of the management staff. No one would dispute developing a strong team being essential to productivity, but what tips do you have for creating strong teams?
Just like you started with yourself and assessing your own strengths, do so with your team members. One thing you can do is look at sometimes their personnel files because you're a manager and see what you know about their performance and what their strengths are. Another thing I usually have people do is also have their employees take the StrengthsFinder assessment. That gives you an objective understanding of what your team member strengths could be so you can possibly allocate tasks based on that. Another big mistake, however, that people make when they are building teams is they don't think about the interpersonal relationships. Do team members get along? Is there a big feud between a couple of team members that if you put them together on a project, will it be World War III? Does a team member resent your promotion? Remember I said earlier, that's something you want to take into account. Something you want to think about too is which team members work better in groups and individually. So you might want to assign tasks to members of the team based on that. If some people like to work in groups, go ahead and have them work in groups, but also give the people who do good individual work sometimes and some tasks that highlight that. Another thing you want to do is think of building a team as a community. You want to make sure if you have a new member or a new hire on a team, make sure you schedule tasks or things socially that they might enjoy. You can take them to some place like Dave & Buster's. You can also invest in having someone come in or going to an activity that does team building. Also, another thing, going back to the learning plan I mentioned earlier, smart managers, when they are building a team, make sure they conduct regular team building exercises on a regular basis to make sure that they are able to iron out problems within the team before they get bigger.
What about team building exercises? Sasha, do they really work?
Yes, and it really depends on, one, the issues that the team is having, and two, whether the person doing the exercises is aware of what the issues the team is having and selects appropriate exercises. Case in point, for one of the jobs I had to go out to Camp Gayasuda, and I had to go on obstacle courses. Now, I'm going to admit that that's my version of hell because I'm not that type of person.
Camp Gayasuda, by the way, is like a Boy Scout camp.
It's a Boy Scout camp.
And maybe a Girl Scout camp now, for all I know, but it's... That is a rigorous little course you have to go through.
Oh, yes, it's a rigorous course. I had to climb walls, and that is totally not my nature. I had to climb also these mock, mountains. And I am not the kind of person. I like my manicures, okay? But the beautiful thing about having been forced to do that, which I, by the way, would not have done on my own, is that, one, I realized that my other team members, if I really had problems with it, with some things I did, they would come back and rescue me. If I also recognize that sometimes that even though I don't like a task and it's going to be difficult for me to do it, I'm just going to have to do like the Nike ad, just do it and see what I can accomplish. And it actually helped me really relate well to my team members. So I know some people think team building exercises can be hokey, and I think they can be if you're selective for team building exercises that are fake, that don't address team problems. But if you're doing it well and you're using exercises that do address team issues that need to be worked on, it can be a useful tool.
And last but not least, delegation is a necessity for managers. This isn't always easy. So what suggestions do you have to make that task flow a little more smoothly?
Absolutely. The first thing you want to do is you want to do both a time audit and you want to do a task audit for at least a week or two. You want to look at your schedule and see, are there lower priority items that can be delegated to other people who are workers? You also know that when you do this and you want to allocate these tasks to other workers, you want to look at the workload of various staff members. Don't do something a lot of people like to do, which is, you know what, this is a really good staff member, so I'm going to throw a lot of these smaller tasks at that person without taking into account how much work that person has to do. You can burn out a good worker, but also you can burn them out to the point that they want to leave you. So you want to nurture that person. Another thing to take into account is who will get things done. and also get them done under standards. One of the mistakes that a lot of managers make is they don't explain why they are having an employee do certain tasks. One of the things that research tells us is if you do explain the reason why an employee is being given a task, they are more likely to complete it and do it well. So that will definitely kind of ensure that you have a better standard for the work that you are delegating. And then finally, you want to look at delegation as an opportunity to develop an employee. Delegate tasks to employees that will help them build their skills, to build their professional profile and effectiveness on the job. So those are the things you want to keep in mind.
So explaining to somebody why you want them to do something instead of do this because I'm telling you to do it generally works better?
Oh, of course. Well, think of all the reasons why that would work. One, that means that you're giving me partial ownership of this because you're saying, okay, I am smart enough to understand the reason why I am doing this. Another thing is you're not being an authoritative leader. One of the big mistakes some people make when they become managers is that they think that being authoritative and barking orders is being a good leader. Good leadership is not barking orders and delegation. Good leadership is doing tasks well, helping out your workers, and therefore they will become more inspired to do a better job.
Independent career consultant Sasha King joins us for our monthly On the Job segment. Sasha King, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you so much, Paul.
And more Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Lower costs and the potential to level the peaks and valleys of supply and demand that strain America's aging power grid are among the benefits hailed by advocates and utilities spending billions of dollars on a system of smart meters. But how exactly will it save you money? And what are the potential downsides of a data-heavy system like this? Today marks the debut of a three-part series WESA is producing in conjunction with the Tribune Review, looking at the personal, financial, and societal impact smart meters will have on residents of the region. I'm joined now in studio by 90.5 WESA reporter Liz Reed and Trib reporter David Conti. Liz, David, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks. Thanks for having us on today.
Join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH at WESA.FM. On Twitter at ESSPGH. There are people that are already doing this. We'd like to hear from you if you're one of those. What do you think of this idea? 412-246-2002. And I think that we should start with the obvious question that must be asked, which is, what is a smart meter and how does it work?
Well, there's two main differences between your traditional meter and a smart meter. A smart meter allows bidirectional, meaning two-way communication. Not only does the meter communicate with the utility company, but the company can communicate back with your meter. It can, you know, in theory, turn your power on or off, diagnose problems, things like that.
And this is one of the things that's creeping people out, but we'll get to that.
Potentially. There's potential there. It also sends data more frequently. So normally you just know how much energy you use in 1 month. With smart meters, you'll know how much energy you're using on an hourly basis.
Why is this switch being made?
Well, it was called for in a state law in 2008. It was Act 129. And this was a larger effort by state lawmakers to bring energy conservation. So there are several points to this law, and this is one of them. It directed the utilities to do this. They have had several years to plan it out. And now here in western Pennsylvania, the major utilities, Duquesne Light and the First Energy utilities, they really started in earnest in the installations last year, and they're really in the midst of it right now.
And the idea is that you'll be able to log into a portal and mm-hmm. see your energy usage on an hourly basis. And so if you can say, well, gee, I turned my air conditioner on at 2 o'clock in the afternoon or whatever, and I could see the difference in how much energy was being used and thus how much energy you're spending, that might change the consumer's habits. There is also this element of time of day pricing. I'll let Dave explain that.
Well, will people actually do this? You know, are people going to keep close track of their energy usage the way this is designed for them to do?
Not everybody. I mean, you know, right now, does everybody look closely at their bills? Of course not. That's why we have identity thieves in some cases, because people don't pay attention to their bills. But this puts the power in the consumer's hands to be able to do that, to be able to adjust their own. And in that regard, this time of day pricing, if utilities go in that direction, and there is talk that some of them want to, at least Duquesne Light says that they want to go in this direction, the consumer will need to, or else they're going to end up paying more, because the time of day pricing, what that entails is now that we will know how much electricity one is using by the hour instead of just in general over the month, the companies will be able to charge different rates for different hours.
So in other words, if you are running the dishwasher at 3 in the afternoon, apparently that's a high volume time, or, you know, in the evening, you know, between 6 and 9, that would be a high volume time. If you time your dishwasher to do the dishes at 2 in the morning, that will save you money because you're doing it at something that's less than a peak time.
Correct. They will ostensibly charge a different rate for using electricity at off-peak hours. And the goal in this is to, as you mentioned at the beginning, is to level those peaks and to bring up those valleys so that the grid is more of a constant instead of having times of very high demand and possibly even constrained supply during those times, and very low demand when there is plenty of supply.
And we know that there are some people that are already doing this because you, in your piece, David, profiled one of them.
Yeah, and now he does not have an actual smart meter attached yet, but he is obviously very interested in seeing and learning about where his energy is going and what it's doing and scheduling that. And, you know, Liz had a long conversation with him about that.
Yeah, he lives in Dormont. His name's John Essie, and he and his wife are sort of cobbling together this smart home. But I say cobbling together because it's all these disparate pieces. You know, he's got all these sensors. He's got like a fob on his dog's collar so he could see. He would get an alert on his phone if his dog got out of the yard. He's got a sensor under his baby's mattress, so it sends him an alert to his watch when his baby starts moving over 50% of the time. That means his baby's probably waking up. He's got a sensor in the basement that tells him if there's water in the basement. So, and then on top of that, he's got a smart thermostat that's tracking his energy consumption. This is obviously someone who's an early adopter. This is someone who, when he gets a smart meter, he is going to look at that data. But, you know, he brought up this concept of friction. Right now, there's a lot of friction, meaning it's really hard to set up these devices. It's really hard to set up these systems. So the key to encouraging people to, you know, not only look at their data, but then make changes based on the data is going to be how easy it is. How easy is it to log in and understand, not just see the data that's there, but understand what it means. And then to make those changes, is it going to be easy to make the changes, or is it going to be complicated?
Well, and people want easy, and that's why a lot of people don't read their bills, because the bills are not, you know, the way it's broken down, a lot of people just start looking at it and go, just toss it in the pile and look for what the total is and, you know, write the check. But with this huge increase in data come data privacy concerns, and some individuals are even organizing an effort to repeal this law. Are these legitimate concerns?
Well, anytime organizations are going to increase the amount of data that they are receiving, of course there's a concern there, because the question is, what are you going to do with that data? And how are you going to make sure that it stays safe? And what can people glean from that data? And I think that there's potentially still some question marks to those questions, particularly on the what people can glean from that data. The utilities and experts say at the end of the day, these companies are just going to get the same type of data. It is the number of electrons that they're using, and there's no information that says that so and so was had his TV on at this hour instead of using his treadmill. But there are those who say, well, you can look for patterns in that use in those straight electrons to glean some amount of information.
You might be able to find out when people are home.
Right.
Sure.
And one of the ways that the utilities say that they're doing with this is when the data comes out of your meter, it doesn't include any personal identifying information. So that stream of, you know, ones and zeros doesn't say where you live or what your name is or your social security number. Now, hypothetically, someone could like hack into the system and
get how do we know the data is secure?
Well, how do we know anybody's data is secure, I guess?
Yeah.
You know, this is predicated on the idea that don't worry, nobody can ever get at this information,
sure.
But what if they can?
Sure,
And is there a guarantee that they cannot get at it?
All they can say in that regard is that they are following standards that were set by several industry groups and that regulators such as the Public Utility Commission are going to keep a very close eye on the measures that they take,
In other words, no.
And I mean, you trust whoever made your, you know, wireless modem that people can't hack into it. You trust Google, maybe to a certain extent, to keep your searches private and to keep your email private. I mean, you put a lot of trust in this increasingly data-driven world. Like, we put massive amounts of personal data out into the world every day, and we're trusting that, that it's going to be secure.
Think about the information that Giant Eagle has on you if you use an Advantage card. Or a credit card company has on you as far as when and where you charge certain things. You know, we trust them. We have to at this point, or else we kind of need to leave the grid.
I kind of subscribe to the Alonzo Bowden philosophy, which is that nobody's spying on you. You're just not that interesting. We're talking with Liz Reed and David Conte, who are very interesting and have embarked on an interesting 3-part series looking at smart meters and how they will impact the personal, financial, and societal aspects of our world. And there are also, we understand, health issues involved with this. What about those?
Well, we don't know for sure that there are health issues. Health concerns, yeah. So smart meters are communicating in a similar way to like how your cell phone communicates. And so, you know, we've heard, you know, in the last decade or so, concerns, you know, that these radio waves could cause cancer. The World Health Organization has actually embarked on a multi-year study of, these radio waves, and they're actually supposed to put out a report next year. But so far, there's really no compelling evidence that there's a cancer-causing element here.
And you consider the other items in our homes that also emit these same kind of waves, your microwave, your cell phone. Now, I carry my cell phone right now in a place that if this is really emitting something that is dangerous to me, I should think about the side of my body that it's the pocket that it's sitting in. But I don't think about that. I'm not really concerned about that.
Nobody's really brought that up recently.
No, they haven't. Now, so this meter will sit outside your house. This is something that's outside your home. It's in that same place. It just replaces the meters that are on there now. So there are obviously concerns, like you said, but I think they're out there as far as any kind of certainty to it.
There is one quick point I want to make back on the data part. You know, one of the concerns that we could see coming up is law enforcement access to this data. Both Duquesne Light and First Energy said that they would cooperate with any government subpoena. Well, there was a U.S. appeals court decision in 2012 that said that the Drug Enforcement Agency, for example, doesn't need a judge's signature to get that electrical usage data. So there's this question of the activities you do inside your home create data, but the data lives outside your home. So what's the protection there?
Is it different? That's a whole legal labyrinth you've just opened up there. We have less than a minute left. I have a couple very quick questions. What does this mean in 10 seconds? Sum this up. What does this mean for energy conservation on a large scale?
On a large scale, this really sets up the utilities to be able to plug in and take different actions because they'll have a much better picture of the needs by neighborhood, by home, of what they need to supply and those demands, and that will open the door for more renewable sources.
And in parts of the city where people lose their power on a routine basis, how does this impact how utilities deal with power outages?
Well, it may they might be able to diagnose the problem without sending someone out. So if they can diagnose it, in some cases, they can even fix it remotely.
More accurate information leads to a quicker solution to the problem.
That's the idea.
By Liz home Reed, instead of by neighborhood.
Liz Reed and David Conti, thank you so much. Check out their three-part series on smart meters. Tomorrow, we'll look at the continuing effort to legalize medical marijuana in Pennsylvania. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.